ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for Wednesday evening, 15th day of March, year of our Lord, 2017. James Corbett will be joining us after our first break, so he should be here in about 18 minutes or so, 20 minutes. Be calling in from Japan. All right, now we'll do the morning report, or the market report, the morning report. I used to do morning reports years ago during 1966-67, when I was in the military. I wound up having a clerical job in the office. I was a very skilled soldier. I knew how to type. At that time, the Army ran on its typewriters. If anything happened to the typewriters, you could get away with, they could lose the tanks or the jeeps or whatever, but you lose the typewriters and all the paperwork disappears and the Army was completely lost. So I was a master of the typewriter and therefore a morning report clerk back in the day. Now we're doing the market report. A little different. Gold is up $21.10 today to $1,220.70 per ounce. Silver was up 48 cents. That's almost 2.9%, 48 cents to $17.43 per ounce. Platinum was up 17. Big day for precious metals. $957 for platinum. Palladium was up $19, over nearly 2.6%, $765 per ounce. Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 112 points, almost 113 points to 20,950. NASDAQ was up 43 points to 5,900. New York Stock Exchange was up 131 points to 11,590. Standard & Poor's was up almost 20 points to 2,385. U.S. dollar was down a little over a point today and is currently at 100.55. And crude oil gained 27 cents over in the evening in the evening markets, and it is currently at $49.13 per ounce. Most people attribute the numbers to Janet Yellen and the fact that they raised the interest rate quarter of a percent. And in fact, according to Yahoo News, here's a small headline on it. Fed raises rates, sees two more hikes this year. For the first time this year, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, a widely expected move following strengthening economic reports and signals from Fed officials. The Federal Open Market Committee voted to raise the range of federal funds rate to 0.75% and 1%, citing progress in labor market growth, business, fixed investment, and inflation. Right. It's no surprise that they raised the interest rate. The Fed has been telling us for several weeks they were absolutely positively going to raise the interest rates. And they pretty much had to. If they hadn't done it, it would belie whatever reports they've issued to indicate that the economy is improving. If the Fed didn't raise interest rates, it would be deemed evidence that the economy was, in fact, on the skids. As it is, they raised interest rates in order to maintain the story that the gross domestic product and the national economy were, we're doing well and heading up into positive territory. I have to wonder whether that's true or false, though. And what I mean, is the economy really getting better? Is it really strong enough? Is it stronger than it was, say, 90 days ago? Is it justifiable that the rate be raised another quarter of a percent based on an improving economy. Is that justifiable? I mean, there's other reasons to raise the interest rate. One of the reasons is that you can't continue to rob creditors indefinitely. Insofar as they hold the interest rate down near zero, and that's what they've been doing for most of the past 8 years, they have allegedly encouraged borrowing, because interest rates are so low, people say, yeah, give me some of that. They're giving the money away practically. And if you could lay hands on it, you could get it very inexpensively, and you could use it for whatever purposes you had in mind, assuming you had a credit rating, good credit rating. The problem with making interest rates, setting them at a near zero level, is that it might be great for borrowers, but it's horrific for lenders. And lenders are sitting back and say, look, I'm entitled. I've got capital. I have saved. I have worked hard. I've produced. I've generated a profit. I've saved my money. I would like to lend it at a reasonable interest rate. And for most of the last 8 years, it hasn't been reasonable from the perspective of the lenders. It's been great from the perspective of the borrowers. But it's been bad for lenders. And the consequence is significant. I've talked about this before on the program, but I don't think I've talked about it in the evening programs, like tonight. There was a time when the Federal Reserve could control the economy to a significant degree by adjusting interest rates and the money supply. And that was monetary policy, which was in control of the Federal Reserve. Fiscal policy was in control of the federal government, and that would monitor, and that would control how much the federal government was spending. If they spent more, it would stimulate the economy. If they spent less, it would slow the economy down. Spending and, can't think of the second one right now, tax rate. If they raise taxes, that should slow the economy. If they lower taxes, that should stimulate the economy. That was fiscal policy. But talking about monetary policy, which was under the control of the Federal Reserve, monetary policy controlled the quantity of money that was in circulation, and it also controlled the interest rate. And when we had gold and silver, using it as our money, the Fed's control was significant. And the reason, from my perspective, one of the reasons, was that it wasn't easy to move your gold or silver to a foreign country. If the Federal Reserve dropped the interest rate significantly, American lenders could not easily move their money from the United States to, say, Europe or a third world country, maybe South America, Uruguay, Argentina, wherever, that was paying a high interest rate, because you ran the risk. You put the gold, you put the silver on a ship, and you move it to some foreign country. There's a risk that the ship is going to sink. And if it does, it takes your gold and your silver to the bottom with it. The oceans, you got the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Pacific Ocean on the other side, and Mexico wasn't going to borrow much, and Canada wasn't going to borrow much. So the American creditors, people who had money to lend, they were pretty much trapped within the continental United States. If they had money to lend and the Federal Reserve established a low interest rate that they didn't like, they were pretty much caught in a take-it-or-leave-it situation. You could either lend money at a rate that the Federal Reserve had more or less specified, or you could just park your money on the sidelines and don't make any interest off of it whatsoever. And the result was that people who had money would say, well, I'd rather make 2% than make nothing. And even though the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates, the money supply was not adversely impacted by low interest rates. They could also control the money supply by other means and control how much money got into the economy, but the interest rate control was pretty strong back in the day. But once we had a pure fiat currency that was no longer backed by gold and silver, And particularly once we invented the internet, that was Al Gore who invented the internet, as you may recall, allegedly. Once we had the internet, we had digital currency. Now currency can circle the globe at the speed of light. And if the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates today, creditors are not trapped in this country. They can move their money. They want to move it to Germany. They can. They want to move it to France. They can. They want to move it to Russia, China, Japan, South America, at the speed of light. And the point being that when the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, it doesn't simply stimulate the economy the way some people would imagine, at least it has in the past. Today, if you lower interest rates beyond what is perhaps a reasonable return on investment, the creditors will simply move their money to another country, another region, where they can get a fair return or a generous return. And the net result here in the United States is when they lower interest rates, the money supply actually declines, which tends to slow the economy. And where it used to be that if you lowered interest rates, you would stimulate the economy, now when you lower interest rates, you might actually slow the economy. And we saw some evidence of that during the Great Recession over the last 8 years, where the government would issue billions of dollars, often to the banks, the institutions that were too big to fail. They'd issue billions of dollars per month under quantitative easing, and much of that money went to third world countries. It was theoretically intended that they would give the money to the banks, and the banks would loan it to the American people. But insofar as they not only gave them money under quantitative easing, gave the banks billions of dollars to lend, they also lowered the interest rate here in the United States. And the banks said, well, thanks very much for giving us those billions of dollars, but we're nobody's fool. We're not going to lend that money to the American people if we're only going to get a couple percent in return. We can lend that money into Europe or Africa or South America, and we can get maybe 8-10%, which is what they did. And billions of dollars went overseas and stimulated the third world. The third world got a great deal of stimulus in large measure because we have a low interest rate in this country. Right? Capital flees. So my point is, when the Fed raises rates today, earlier today, it has to be done in part to keep capital in this country. It has to be done because you can't keep ripping off the creditors in order to stimulate borrowing for the lenders. Somewhere along the line, there has to be a fairness in the interest rate, and it can't just be artificially controlled and artificially suppressed or increased indefinitely. You know, there was a time when the free market would set the interest rate effectively. When the Federal Reserve attempts to set the interest rate, especially over a period of time, as we've seen in the last 8 years, the Federal Reserve sets up an interest rate that is artificial. And it might be at times it's fair for it's great for the borrowers and it's terrible for the lenders. It might at other times be great for the lenders and terrible for the borrowers. I don't know that we can point to an example of that. But when the Fed controls this interest rate for an extended period of time, the Fed is setting up something unreal, irrational. Right? It does not reflect reality. These rates are not being set by the free market. And the Fed thinks, they seem to think at least, that they can cleverly manipulate the interest rates, they can cleverly manipulate the money supply, and they can make the economy go faster or slower. But the last 8 years have pretty much shown us that the Fed is losing its power to manipulate the economy. We have to give them credit. We did not fall into a Great Depression, right, which I think was possible. The Fed prevented us probably from going into a Great Depression, but the Fed was not, during those 8 years, it did not succeed in stimulating the economy in a meaningful sense. They may have avoided a Great Depression, but they did not stimulate the economy where everybody said, yippee, we're getting rich again. There's a point here. And the point is, first off, the Fed is losing control. It no longer exercises the same amount of control over the economy that it enjoyed 15, 20 years ago. Certainly not 50 years ago. Right? The Fed had more control. Now it's somewhat desperate just to prove that it's still relevant. Plus, we have two options right now in broad terms. We could go into deflation where the dollar becomes worth more, or we could go into inflation where the dollar becomes worth less. Inflation is great for borrowers because they get to pay off their debts in cheaper dollars. The United States government is the biggest borrower in the world. It wants inflation. It needs inflation. All right? It hasn't been able to get much lately, but that's what it wanted. That's what it's wanted. That's what it needs. The Federal Reserve, on the other hand, they need deflation to shore up the dollar. If the dollar's lost 95% of its purchasing power over the course of the last, since 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window. It is inevitable that if we continue with the little inflation, little inflation, little inflation, the dollar is going to go, right now they've lost actually 96, 97% of its purchasing value to inflation over the past 46 years. They could go another percent, another percent, another percent. Pretty soon the dollar is worth nothing. At which point the dollar dies. That's got to be bad for the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has to want deflation. Right, in order to preserve their one and only product, which is fiat currency. But the government wants inflation in order to pay off its debt with cheaper dollars. And the point I'm trying to make is that it seems to me that while the Federal Reserve and the federal government have seemed to work hand in glove for the last 40 or 50 years, I think we're now at a point where things are so desperate that they can no longer do that. For the government to avoid being insolvent, which would be aggravated by deflation, they've got to have inflation. They can't stand deflation. The Federal Reserve, on the other hand, if we continue to inflate, the dollar becomes worthless. And what happens then? So what I'm trying to get to is we now see, it appears to me that the federal government and the Federal Reserve are acting with their cross purposes. They're no longer working hand in glove. They have competing interests. And in the end, they're both in danger right now, and there's a question, who is going to survive? And if I had to guess, I'd say the Federal Reserve is going to disappear, although it might be a couple of years before it happens. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. I'll be back shortly with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on shortwave radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, calling in from Japan. And James is the originator and behind the Corbett Report, and he's got a couple other websites and blogs, and you see his name more and more in respected publications, or at least collections of respected publications. His opinions are increasingly valued, and he's making a certain amount of headway on a global basis, being recognized by readers, an audience of readers, and also other pontificators. Are you a pontificator, James?
That is certainly one way to describe me, yes.
All right. Let's start with Vault 7. On March 7th, the transparency disclosure activists at WikiLeaks began releasing a series of documents titled Vault 7. According to the New York Times, Vault 7 consists of thousands of pages describing sophisticated software tools and techniques used by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to break into smartphones, computers, and even internet-connected televisions. If the documents are authentic, and WikiLeaks has a sterling reputation when it comes to document authenticity, every paranoid thriller you've ever watched or read was too timid in describing a hypothetical surveillance state. Even the telescreens and random audio bugs of George Orwell's 1984 don't come close to the reality of the CIA's surveillance operations. What do you know about Vault 7? And is it something to do with, is this worthy of genuine concern, or is this much ado about nothing?
Well, it's certainly interesting, and it certainly, at least at first blush from what has been reported so far, seems to confirm a number of things that have been talked about, speculated upon, and pontificated by people like myself and other conspiracy theorists for quite some time. For example, the idea that smart TVs are, in fact, watching you. In Soviet USSA, TV watches you. Or, for example, the various ways that not only iPhones, but iOS in general, and Linux and Windows and other operating systems have been compromised. Also, the idea of virtual false flag attacks, i.e., the implanting of certain code to make it look like a foreign power, for example, Russia, is committing a cyber attack of some sort when in fact it is the CIA. So these types of things have been talked about by myself and others for years, but here seems to be some sort of documentary proof of these various things. One of the attention-grabbing, headline-grabbing pieces that emerged first of all from this release was the revelation, not that it was much of a revelation, I suppose, but the confirmation that the CIA has looked into, for example, how to commandeer a car, because, of course, cars are increasingly technologically wired in and can be compromised from remote locations and basically taken over. And, of course, this relates to such things as the mysterious 3 a.m. fiery crash of and death of Michael Hastings, the journalist who has, for amongst other things, taken down high-ranking military members with his reporting and had threatened that he was working on a large story about the intelligence community and saying he had to go under the radar. And lo and behold, he ends up dying in a very fiery and spectacular 3 a.m. crash in very strange circumstances, immediately preceding which we had former National Security Advisor Richard Clark coming out and saying, you know, the intelligence agency, or it is possible to remotely commandeer cars. It was a very strange admission for the National Security Advisor to be making in the immediate wake of Hastings' death, but there it was. Now, of course, this is part of the Vault 7 leak. So there's a lot of very interesting things, but I think this comes with some caveats, as always. I mean, I guess there's the question of authenticity, and of course the CIA is not going to come out and say, yep, these documents are authentic, so I don't know, but I think that's a bit of a red herring. I don't think that anyone has seriously called into question any of the specific things that have been reported yet, but perhaps more importantly, for people who haven't actually looked at the actual documents themselves, I highly encourage them to do so, or at least take a look at one or two of them. You can go to WikiLeaks.org and take a look at the documents, and despite what pontificators on CNN and other places have said in the past, it is not illegal to look at documents on WikiLeaks. So I encourage people to do so and try to take a look at some of these documents, and you'll quickly discover that it is technobabble. It is technological gobbledygook, at least to myself, and I'm sure most of the audience out there who are not technologically inclined. So as I pointed out on my New World Next Week program with James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, I pointed out at the time when we covered this last week, basically all of the information we're getting from this is going to have to come through interpretation of these documents from those in who are conversant in technobabble. So that's a bit of a caveat, and it means that there is a large degree of probability that there will be some misreporting here and there along the way. For example, that story that I talked about earlier, this seems to be confirmation that the CIA has worked on ways of trying to crack and hack cars so that they can commandeer them. And the suggestion that's been floated through the media, including myself, as I picked up on at the time, that this might have something to do with the death of Michael Hastings. Hastings died in 2013, and these documents are talking about CIA programs that were underway in 2014. So, for example, this does not actually add to the to our understanding of what may or may not have happened to Hastings, per se. So those are the types of things that can happen because people are reporting on reporting of reporting of reporting of the documents themselves rather than looking at the documents themselves. So there's a lot of potential for misinformation being, or even just, genuine errors sneaking into the reporting here. And then I guess the other part of this is the bigger question of government surveillance in general and what this means and whether people are simply being conditioned to accept the fact that they are being watched at all times in all aspects of their daily life. You'll notice that at this precise moment, another major story has come out with, of course, Donald Trump having accused Obama of wiretapping the Trump Tower during the transition period last fall, and this leading to Kellyanne Conway making the now infinitely parodied remark that they're spying on you through your microwave, which is being lauded as one of the stupidest things that anyone has ever said, blah, blah, blah. Whereas Wired.com, The Huffington Post, other mainstream outlets just a few years ago was reporting that CIA spy chief at the time, David Petraeus, was bragging that the CIA would be able to spy on people through their dishwashers. Yes, your smart appliances will be a valuable tool for the CIA and other intelligence agencies to collect information about you. This has been openly talked about for years, but now you're a crazy conspiracy theorist for mentioning it. So it's a very strange and topsy-turvy world that we're living in, and a lot of these things are in flux right now. But I think the only thing that we can count on is that the government is going to try to basically use this as a justification to put the pedal to the metal. I don't see any sign that there's going to be any brakes put on by a Trump administration, given that Trump, for example, in the past called Edward Snowden, whatever you think of him and his revelations, quote-unquote, a traitor that deserved to be killed, and has made ominous overtures about WikiLeaks in regards to recent events. So I don't know. I don't think there's going to be any change whatsoever in government policy of trying to spy on everyone at all times. And I think people should understand that that's at least the goal, and if not, something that's already been realized by the intelligence agencies.
Harv, you've been warning about this, or at least reporting on this subject, for a number of years. I presume you've been warning about it, not just commenting per se, but warning about it. What you see in Vault 7, in the Vault 7 story, is this as bad as you thought? Is it worse than you thought? Or is it right on target? It's pretty much what you expected.
Well, this is only a tiny fraction of what we already know, let alone what is available. I mean, this is apparently represents less than 1% of the total Vault 7 documents that WikiLeaks is going to release. So this is just the beginning of the reporting. So we'll have to see. But so far, I mean, as I say, everything that's coming out seems to confirm things that we already did know from various different sources. I mean, for example, the idea that smart TVs can watch you is not exactly new information. The idea of cars being hacked into, for example, again, not new information. Even Richard Clark was talking about it a few years ago. The idea of the possibility of CIA false flag cyber attacks, again, is more something that is intuitively understandable rather than, I mean, it's good to have the confirmation there that they have an actual program, Umbridge, that works on collecting repositories of these cyber attacks so that they can use those fingerprints basically in the future. But again, that's not something that you necessarily need to have explained to you to understand. So I'm not sure that, again, this seems to be perhaps in a similar fashion to Snowden, more of a confirmation of many things that we already have from other sources. And I guess the danger, again, like Snowden, is that people might think that all of this relies on that one particular source and that this is all, let's put all our eggs in this particular basket, when really this is just one more confirmation of something we already knew, one more piece of a giant puzzle that we've been looking at for many years. And the danger is that many important other important pieces of that puzzle will get overlooked. For example, a couple of weeks ago, I noticed, or maybe a week and a half ago, I noted that myself and Ron Paul and others had been talking about how Trump's warning about wiretapping is something of a red herring, because it does bring to mind that Cold War era idea of people sneaking in and putting physical bugs on the line or something of the telephones, where of course that is not necessary, and of course warrants themselves are not necessary for such thing. There doesn't have to be a paper trail for a type of tap that might go on like that. For example, one way that we know that intelligence agencies get around this, U.S. is part of the echelon system of the Five Eyes, that, for example, that coordinate with each other, the British intelligence, Canadian intelligence, Australian intelligence, American intelligence. They all cooperate with each other so that it may be illegal for an American intelligence agency to spy on American citizens, but they can certainly get that information from one of their partner cohorts for whom that collection is not illegal. If, for example, a Briton is spying or tapping on a certain line and an intelligence agency gets the information from them, then it's all legal, right? Those are the types of ways around this. And of course, we already know that the NSA is already collecting all of the communication data that they can, including telephone calls, not just the metadata, but the actual content of those calls. That was made clear on CNN, on the Aaron Burnett program, back in 2013, shortly before Snowden came on the scene. They were already confirming that on the nightly news, that they had access to specific phone calls that had been made weeks ago by people who were at that time not under direct surveillance. They had access to the actual phone calls themselves. Aaron Burnett and then a subsequent CNN host the next night asked the FBI source, Tim Clemente, to verify that that was what he was saying, and he confirmed it. The FBI and intelligence agencies generally have access to specific phone calls, even weeks after the fact, which confirms that the NSA really is tapping absolutely directly into the trunk lines of the communication fibers that are going across the United States. They collect the data itself, not just the metadata. And yeah. And that further piggybacks on what we've been told by other NSA whistleblowers, like, for example, Russ Tice, who was on the Corbett Report back in, I believe, 2013, when he confirmed that during his time at the NSA, he had seen the actual orders to look into the communications of people like high-ranking generals, judges, and politicians, including even back in 2004 when he was still running for state senate, a little-known political figure by the name of Barack Obama. So even in 2004, the NSA was specifically tapping his communications. So this should not be any surprise. The only thing that is questionable here is whether there will be any sort of paper trail whatsoever to show that Obama was spying on Trump, per se. But again, the false narrative here is it's perfectly fine for the U.S. to listen to literally every single American citizen except the president-elect. I mean, that's over the line. You can't listen to those phone calls. But anyone else on the planet, sure. But just not those political godly figures. So there's many ways that these types of stories can be revealing and, in a sense, cover up a type of limited hangout at the same time.
What's government going to do with all that data? I mean, it seems the only thing they can do, they can look back at all my phone calls. If they have for selective prosecution. But I don't think they can keep. I'm curious. Do you think they can monitor they certainly can't monitor everybody on an ongoing basis, on a live, moment by moment basis. They can store the communications and go back later if they find out, wait a second, this guy was up to something. Let's go back and see what he was doing. But there's too much data certainly for living people to absorb and categorize. I don't doubt computers can do some of this, but just the same, they're getting an awful lot of data, and what are they going to do with it all?
Well, I think you're right. It's important to understand that, of course, this doesn't mean an agent is listening to every single call you make. It is simply being stored for future uses. And I think we get a sense of this. This is something that is intuitively understandable. Again, you can look back 20 years ago at a movie like Enemy of the State, the Will Smith action movie, which shows at least the idea. If someone is targeted by an intelligence agency because they come into contact with valuable information, they can become that target. And that amount of data that can be collected on someone and then stored and sitting there waiting can give an incredible amount of insight into your life, into everything you do, who you interact with, where you go, and can make you, compromisable if need be, or ultimately targetable in various ways. But this goes even deeper. I mean, there's an even more chilling aspect to all of this, if that can be imagined, that really comes to the fore. I'm currently reading War Against the Weak, Eugenics in America's Campaign to Create a Master Race by Edwin Black, a really, really extremely important summation of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century and its aims and goals and where it was heading and how it started. Really, it started in England, but its real home base was in the United States, where, of course, forced sterilizations and other things ultimately ended up taking place. And I'm just reading this part about Charles Davenport, who created the Eugenics Record Office, a chilling idea to basically collect as much data on people as possible to try to come up with their sort of the understanding of their family lineage, their family tree, so that when you identify someone that you want to take out of the gene pool, you can look through all of this data and find, oh, well, you had an uncle who was a pauper, or you had a great grandfather who at some point committed a crime. Therefore, your entire family lineage is tainted. Therefore, we think you are feeble-minded or you're unfit to breed, and you can be literally involuntarily sterilized. Again, this isn't just a crazy conspiracy idea. This actually happened in history.
I understand that.
So giving governments this type of access to data is in and of itself a very, very
dangerous
proposition.
All right, let's take a break for a couple commercials. We'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. I'm here with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we've been talking about Vault 7, which is a revelation, WikiLeaks revelation concerning the spy apparatus that's being used by the intelligence agencies in this country against the American people. And what we're seeing in the article that I read where we introduced this idea, where they talked about the surveillance state. Is there any difference between the surveillance state and what people are coming to call the deep state? And is the deep state primarily intelligence agencies operating from around the world? Is that the foundation of something like a new world order?
That's a very, that's a very perceptive question, but it has a lot of layers to it. I would say that the surveillance state, if we were to use that term, is more a description of the way that that state functions. That is the type of mechanism for control of the state. But the deep state is more the sort of organization of the structure of the state. And the point has been made, for example, recently by Douglas Valentine on the Guns and Butter radio program, where he was making the point that the deep state, I mean, it's kind of a meaningless word, because the deep state is the state. That really is what the state is and what it does and how it functions. And our ignorance of that is, to a certain extent, not really excusable. It's because so many of the machinations and operations of this deep state are out in the open and are codified in law and are staffed and run by people whose names we know, and or at least could know if we bothered to look into them, who have histories, who are involved in certain programs that are part of the public record. So a lot of what we consider the deep state is really just unreported parts of the state itself. In terms of the really deep state of the drug running of the CIA and things like that, obviously that is certainly not on public record, although there is, I mean, even with that, you look in the 1990s and the various Senate and congressional investigations into that, where even John Kerry at the time was admitting, yes, the CIA was involved with drug runners that they knowingly engaged with, but for some reason or other, that didn't really become a key point of his 2004 campaign for some reason. But to a certain extent, the deep state really is just the state. That is the way the state operates. And the takeover, if there was a takeover, happened in 1947 with the National Security Act and the formalization of the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency and the codification of the different parts of the intelligence apparatus. But by this point, generations deep into this manifestation of the deep state, I mean, it really is indistinguishable from the state itself. And I think that's what we're at the very least, at least there is a societal conversation taking place about this at this moment, although bizarrely enough, of course, now we see the people on the left side of the political spectrum, or at least what we're taught is the acceptable political spectrum, now effectively curing for that deep state because they see it to be in confrontation, or at least think it to be in confrontation with the Trump administration, and they don't like Trump, so they must like this idea of intelligence agencies secretly running the government from behind the scenes. It is a bizarre world we're living in, but I think the surveillance state it certainly does exist. As I say, the NSA really is collecting and capturing it all, and the CIA and other agencies have their ways of getting their hands on this information, and that is really the mechanism by which the deep state obviously maintains and leverages its control over the population generally, but more specifically over politicians or generals or judges that are come under its purview. Of course, as WikiLeaks points out, what did the CIA do with its hacking powers that are being revealed in Vault 7? They, for example, broke into the computer systems of the Senate and attempted to scuttle the torture report that the Senate had. Do you remember that story? That
was I remember the torture report. I remember that, but I don't know if it was partially scuttled. Was it neutered to some degree, or were they unsuccessful, totally unsuccessful in suppressing the information?
The CIA was attempting to, if I recall the story correctly, they were attempting to hack into, basically to steal the report from, as in to read it ahead of time from the Senate.
So they'd know how to defend against it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So that, I mean, that is essentially what, I mean, this is the real power of government generally, but obviously when these tools are in the hands of, quote unquote, the deep state, this is the real power that they wield over everyone and anyone. The only people who will get into positions of power where they could even potentially threaten these covert systems of control are themselves going to be compromised individuals, precisely because that is exactly the types of people that the deep state will want in those positions. And if they don't want you in those positions, then things will be found in your record, or they will be manufactured in your record, or you know, the occasional plane crash or what have you is still used as a political tool. And I think that, I mean, it's a real question. I mean, it's the question, how do you remove the cancer? How do you kill the cancer?
Well, I'm not even sure. Can you tell how big the cancer is?
Well, that's...
I mean,
if I walk
in the door and I told you I'm a member of the deep state and you better do what I say, well, are we all... Does everyone in the deep state carry an identification card? I mean, there might be... This may whole thing may be something of a myth where there's two or three people, a couple of hackers in a garage someplace that claim to be the deep state. And everybody believes that there's something massive going on here, but how does one member of the deep state recognize another member of the deep state?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, it really is one of the sort of the tricks of that language plays upon us. It's like when you call anonymous anonymous, it sounds like, oh, this is a group with card-carrying members, and we can identify this person is anonymous, this person is not anonymous. No, anonymous is whoever takes on that label. The deep state, again, makes it sound like it is a coordinated, monolithic institution with a hardwired chain of command that is performing a singular action towards a singular goal. I think that's that cannot be the way that such a thing functions. It is a loosely coordinated collection of people in various positions of power inside and outside of government who have interests that coincide at certain points. I think that's the way we have to understand that, and it's much more difficult to put your finger on that, but it's much more, I think, a reflection of the way reality actually functions. So that so precisely the point is that the cancer analogy is a failed analogy, because it really gives us the idea that there is some way to distinguish between cancer and host, that the host is not really what we identify as the cancer, and the cancer is not what we identify as the host. But I think they are absolutely intermingled. It is really the question of the centralization of power in the first place, the centralization of power that is inherent in the federal government, that is, I think, obviously it's a tool, and it's going to be used and wielded by evil people at least as much, if not more so, than it's wielded by good people. And the evil people tend to weed the good people out of the the power that could ever use that tool anyway. And of course, it's all based on the fundamental evil of taxation is theft and things along those lines, but that's a bit philosophical for most people at this point. But still, I think the point is that this is obviously used as a weapon against the people generally, and certainly against their rivals, not only politically, but also in business, of course. Let's not be naive to think that there are strong business interests as well in using, for example, the apparatus of the surveillance state to make sure that certain corporations, certain cronies, always have a leg up on their competition.
What we're talking about in part is the deep, how big is the deep state really? Are they as scary as some of us fear when we hear about the surveillance that's taken place? Are they monolithic, or are there internal factions in this alleged deep state that are fighting against each other? Same team? If you're in the deep state, you're all on the same team and working for the same goal, or is it possible that there are multiple teams within the deep state, and some of them say yes and some say no?
Yes, I mean, again, I think it's naive to think of this as some sort of monolithic institution with card-carrying members. So, of course, there are people who have different agendas that are motivated by different aims and are working towards different goals. And we can see examples of that. It does surface from time to time. For example, people might be able to cast their mind back to 2007 when Zbigniew Brzezinski was in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And at that time, he was warning of the idea that essentially he was warning of a false flag attack to be blamed on Iran to justify an invasion of Iran. He was saying that any event could very quickly be blamed on Iran, even regardless of any evidence indicating their culpability, as an excuse for justifying an invasion. And that, I mean, those types of incidents, I think, are little signals that probably are not picked up on by the vast majority of the public, but little signals that I think there really are differences of opinion. For example, Brzezinski, I think, tended to represent a different faction of the deep state than the more neocon-type faction that wanted to go in guns blazing into Iran. I think Brzezinski was more of a, no, we have to use more of a subtle strategy of encirclement and taking out key members of their coalition and targeting Syria first and things like that. And so that was a little red flag that goes up to show no, this part of the deep state doesn't want that to happen, and we might we might blow the whistle if you guys try to start something. And as a result, I suppose as a result is a bit presumptuous, but at any rate, coincidentally, not so long after that point, we had Seymour Hersh come out and say that he had, with some of his sources in the government, heard about Dick Cheney's plan to paint up U.S. ships as Iranian PT boats, dress up U.S. servicemen as Iranians, and attack U.S. ships as a way of potentially starting a some sort of incident in the Middle East. Again, that was reported by Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize winner. These types of things, when they come out, I think it shows a little bit of internecine warfare that goes on in the deep state. I mean, it doesn't mean that everyone is on the same team and that they all have the same ideas. And sometimes they show, you know, if you guys try this, we'll blow the whistle because we don't think that's the right way to go. And so they certainly can stab each other in the back. They certainly can knife each other. And it's one of those situations where here, us on the level of reality, not living in the deep state intelligence world, is it a good thing if they just basically knife each other in the back and, you know, take care of each other that way? Maybe is that the best we can hope for? Or is there some more fundamental way to weed this all out and hope that we don't have to put up with these? But that's the kind of thing that I think points to the fact that, no, not everyone is on the same team. They do not all follow the same agenda. They do not have the same goals necessarily. But when those interests do converge, that is when we see those fracture points in history, like a JFK assassination, like a 9/11. Those types of events benefited many different parts of the deep state.
I agree with that.
For different reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got 3 minutes left on the program. Why don't you give us a fast thumbnail sketch of what's happening with North Korea, South Korea, Japan, and China, where the government is going to install some new ballistic missile defense systems in South Korea, probably in Japan. China's upset. North Korea appears to be run, but they have too much fluoride in the drinking water or something. The leader is a lunatic. What's going to happen over here?
And let's add some even more crisis to this. Of course, we see the very disorderly changeover of power in South Korea with Park Geun-hye having been ousted as president and, you know, the incoming president still to be decided, but looking like it's going to probably be Moon Jae-in of the Minju Party. So that adds a further layer of destabilization to all of this. But I think to a certain extent, this is predictable and predicted because every single year, the United States runs a military exercise called Full Eagle, Operation Full Eagle, which is a mock invasion of the Korean Peninsula. They say, of course, it's to defend against the possibility of a North Korean invasion of South Korea, but effectively, as always, it fully functions as a potential mock exercise to invade North Korea. And they do things like drop dummy nuclear warheads on the Korean Peninsula and other things in preparation for this invasion. So this, every single year, they do this exercise, and every single year, North Korea does something crazy and out of nowhere and is reported as, why on earth did they do this at this time? It's always in protest of those military exercises. So this year, of course, they launched four ICBMs that ended up crashing in the Sea of Japan, not very far from where I'm sitting, which has raised Japan to its highest alert level. Now, the Chinese foreign minister came out and said, hey guys, hey United States, why don't you guys stop doing this full-scale mock military invasion of North Korea every year, and we'll talk to North Korea about stopping the nuclear program or halting that. Because, of course, China does ultimately hold the power to do that because North Korea is on the Chinese lifeline, economically speaking. China really could be a deciding factor here. But U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley said, nope, we're not going to even think about doing that. We're going to continue doing our exercises. So it's certainly
and
one
it's
of those...
It's possible that the United States has driven the premier of North Korea nutty with their threats, their persistent threats to invade. And I'm not speaking against the government of the United States. I'm not speaking for North Korea. But in a sense... has it made him unstable?
I think, well, I mean, there's a lot of different things that go into that. One of them is we have to look at the actual history of the development of the North Korean
nuclear
program.
Yeah, we're not
going to
have time for that.
Exactly.
We've got about 5 seconds left right now. James,
well,
we're going to have to
let
it go.
Look into
it. we'll look into it next time we talk to you. Thanks very much for being on the program. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, calling in from Japan. Always look forward to talking to James. Look forward to talking to you in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Todd the producer, and all of the audience. Bye-bye. That's too bad. In my